Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My special guest today is Dr. Alan Robock, a distinguished professor of climatology at the Department of Environmental Sciences at Rutgers University. Professor Robock has published more than 300 articles on his research in the area of climate change, including more than 170 peer-reviewed papers. His areas of expertise include geoengineering, climatic effects of nuclear war, effects of volcanic eruptions on climate, regional atmosphere hydrology modelling, and soil moisture variations. He serves as editor of Reviews of Geophysics, the most highly cited journal in the earth sciences. His honours include being a fellow of the American Meteorological Society, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and the American Geophysical Union. Professor Robock is the lead author of the upcoming fifth assessment report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. Professor Alan Robock, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Thank you.
Well, your work is incredibly important. And I'd like you to go back, Alan, right to the beginning when you and Carl Sagan and others produced the first study on nuclear winter. How was that received? What, in fact, did you discover? And what has happened since that time?
At the end of 1983, the first results of these calculations were presented that showed that a nuclear war between the United States and the Soviet Union would produce so much smoke from the burning cities and industrial areas that it would go up in the air, block out the sunlight, make it cold and dark and dry at the Earth's surface, and have a devastating impact on agriculture around the world. I learned about this in 1982. There was a talk supposed to be given at the American Geophysical Union annual meeting in San Francisco on the climatic effects of nuclear war, and I went to the talk, and it was canceled.
Yeah.
It was done by some people that worked for NASA, Richard Turco, Brian Toon, and they were told by NASA, we don't work on nuclear war. You can't talk about nuclear war. You're forbidden.
And really? So they had to
think up a new name for what they were doing, and they thought up nuclear winter, which had the cause and the result. And the next year, they published a paper on nuclear winter. This was based on a paper by Paul Crutzen, who has since won a Nobel Prize, a real Nobel Prize, in chemistry for his work on ozone. And he suggested that after a nuclear war, there would be fires and smoke. And nobody had thought about that before. It was almost 40 years after nuclear weapons had been invented, and nobody thought about this possible consequence.
What, about cities burning?
Yes.
Good God!
Well, they knew that there would be fires, but nobody realized that there would be so much smoke that it could have implications for the entire world.
Right.
The military people thought of nuclear weapons as just bigger bombs, and they would use it to blow up people, but they didn't think about the environmental consequences.
They just looked at the blast effect, didn't they?
Yes.
But didn't look at the fire or radiation.
Well, they looked at the radiation, but the radiation would be devastating locally, but you go a few hundred miles, a few hundred kilometers away, and it wouldn't really be important.
Yeah.
And so locally, of course, it would be horrible, and I'm really thankful that since the first nuclear war, when the U.S. dropped two bombs on Japan, there hasn't been another one, and people realize how horrible those direct effects would be. But what we discovered in the 1980s is that it would be much worse than that, that more people in China could die from a nuclear war between the United States and Russia than in the United States and Russia combined, even if no bombs were dropped there.
Oh, well, explain why.
Because they would starve to death. The smoke from the fires would block out the sun and make it very cold and dark, and the temperatures would get below freezing in the summertime, and that would kill all the crops.
Well, then, Alan, would you explain to the audience, please, a single bomb, a big Russian bomb, you know, a 20 megaton, 10 megaton, dropping on a city like New York, what would be the ramifications from your perspective?
Well, I only live 100 kilometers from New York, so it depends on the wind. Depending on the wind direction, it might be a personal implication. It would be horrible. It would kill millions of people. It would destroy the city. It would make it uninhabitable for a long time. But and it would be a terrible local impact. And of course, it could produce retaliation, which could lead to a large scale war. But the effect of one bomb dropped in New York, while it would be devastating locally, it wouldn't affect the rest of the world. There would be smoke from the fires. It would go up into the atmosphere. It would be blown away. But it wouldn't be enough to have a global impact. Last year in Australia, there were terrible forest fires in the southeastern part of the country. And they were so intense that they pumped smoke all the way up into the stratosphere, into the area above where we have weather, above where we have rain. And I just read a paper. It was blown all the way around the world. And so that just shows,
really,
as an example, that smoke can be pumped up into the stratosphere and stay there for a long time.
Yeah.
If there were 100 of those at once.
100 of those bombs.
Or 100 fires.
Or 100 fires.
100 yeah. cities, then together that would produce enough climate change to cool the planet more than during the Little Ice Age. But we looked at several scenarios.
This was in the 80s, right?
In the 80s, we looked at a scenario of using one-third of the global arsenal of weapons. So that was about 5,000 megatons explosive power of the bombs.
What's a megaton?
A megaton is is the equivalent explosive power of a million tons of TNT, trinitrotoluene, ingredient in dynamite.
And what were the size of the bombs used in the Second World War, the biggest bombs? Not the nuclear bombs, but the ordinary bombs.
Oh.
In comparison.
Well, I don't know about individual bombs. The total explosive power of all the bombs used in World War II during 5 years when 50 million people died was about 2 megatons.
2 million tons equivalent.
Yeah.
So and the bombs you're talking about now?
Well, the total arsenal has about 5,000 megatons.
Compared
so,
to 2
yeah.
million tons used in the Second World War. So now yeah. we've got 5,000 million tons in the nuclear arsenal of the world today.
Yeah, almost all in the United States and Russian arsenals.
Yes.
So the scenarios we did produced smoke, and we calculated the climate effects in the 1980s. But we didn't have very big computers compared to today, and we couldn't do long calculations, and so the calculations, and we didn't know how long the smoke would stay in the atmosphere, so it showed that in the next year, in the middle of the continents, temperatures would get below freezing. It would be essentially like going from day to night, and the next day would still be nighttime. And you have an intuitive feel of how quickly the temperatures can fall from day to night, and it would just be night after night after night. And temperatures would kill the crops. I mean, Paul Ehrlich would say, you know, if you want to see the effects on the crops, take your mother's African violet plant and put it in the freezer and come back tomorrow and take it out and see how it's doing.
Oh, my God.
So the world's food supply is typically, it's less now, but typically 1 or 2 months of food. And so after you use up all the food and can't grow anymore, it would be really devastating. That's why more people in China could die just from starvation after they run out of food.
And this was in 1982. How many bombs were used? Just 5,000?
Well, there were about 70,000 bombs on the planet, and about a third of them were used. This was the baseline scenario. Let's use a third of the bombs.
A third.
Of
the 70,000, right?
Yeah. So it turns out that Americans and Russians, first of all, there were some conservatives who said, this can't be right. We can't trust these leftist scientists. these college professors, let's spend some money and do some more research. And the more research we did, the clearer it was that we were right. I mean, the basic physics was very simple. If you block out the sun, it gets cold.
Mm.
And so other country, and in the United States and Russia, people said, well, why is this important to us? We already know that nuclear war would be horrible because the bombs would be dropped on us.
Mm.
But other countries around the world said, we didn't realize that it would be horrible for us too, even if we weren't targets. And there was a tremendous amount of pressure from other countries to the U.S. and Russia to end the arms race.
Right.
Mikhail Gorbachev is the guy that did it, and he has been quoted as saying that he learned about the nuclear winter research. One of the strengths of it is that it was done jointly by American and Russian scientists together, working collaboratively, and the results were the same. And so nobody could say it was propaganda from one side or the other. And so the Russians, Gorbachev, realized how horrible the nuclear winter would be and decided to stop building Russian bombs and end the arms race. And the first papers were published in 1983. I published a paper in 1984. And the next year, the arms race ended, and the number of weapons started going down in the world. The Soviet Union didn't end until the end of 1991. More than 5 years later, and so it wasn't the collapse of the Soviet Union that ended the arms race. And Gorbachev has been quoted in a couple different interviews that I know of saying that he knew about nuclear winter, and that's why he acted.
Really?
So you know, why are we talking about it today? The arms race is over. The number of weapons is continuing to go down. The New START agreement, which was signed a year ago, commits the U.S. and Russia to reduce their weapons to get down to about 4,000 altogether by 2017. What's the problem?
Now, wait a minute. They're only their strategic weapons. They're not talking about their tactical weapons.
No, that includes all of them.
Does it?
Yeah.
4,000 on each side?
No. 1,700 to 2,200 on each side.
And that includes tactical as well as strategic?
Yeah, except there's one little
catch. Only strategic.
No, it's all of them, except there's one little catch.
Yeah.
They count each weapon on a missile as one, but they count each bomber, each airplane as one weapon.
And a bomber can carry 20 bombs.
Yeah. So that's one of the catches. I guess it's too hard to inspect how many bombs are on an airplane, but
that's
it's easy
rhubarb.
To inspect how many. Yeah,
that's
but
just,
anyway.
Yeah.
The numbers are going down. The U.S. and Russia are almost down to those levels now in terms of deployed weapons. They have a lot more that they haven't on the shelf, they haven't dismantled, but the number is going down. The rest of the world has another 1,000, so that'll be about 5,000 weapons in 5 years. So what's the problem? And the point, so I did some research recently in the last 5 years, and we asked two questions. One is, if the new arsenal, 5,000 weapons was used, what would be the climatic effect? Could it produce nuclear winter? And the other and the answer is yes. It turns out that even with 5,000 weapons, you could still get the temperatures below freezing. So what we did is we went back and looked at the original research, and we said, you know, I think they targeted two bombs on every target because they weren't that accurate. They wanted to be sure that they hit. So, okay, we put two bombs on every target. We're trying to use up these 5,000 weapons. Okay, and then we still had lots of weapons. And And they still had lots of weapons. It turns out they put 9 bombs on every target back then because they didn't have any enough targets for all the bombs they had.
Well, McNamara and I wrote an article fairly recently to say that there are still 40 bombs targeted on New York as we speak.
Oh, sure.
And 60 on Washington. 60!
Yeah, yeah. So we calculated recently, what if we... That the current arsenal could still produce as much smoke as a third of the arsenal could have in the 1980s. And so you can still produce nuclear winter. We used a modern climate model that now calculates the upper atmosphere, the stratosphere, in much more detail than before.
Mm-hmm.
And it can run for much longer than before. And we found that the smoke would be heated by the sun and lofted up into the stratosphere where it would stay for years.
Mm.
And nobody had done a calculation running it that long before. So even after 10 years, there would still be a lot of smoke up in the atmosphere.
Right.
The climate response would last for years. That's something new that we found. And so... even after the new start is over, it's still really scary. That's still the greatest threat that humans pose to the planet is from nuclear weapons. And I think we have to solve this problem so we have the luxury of worrying about global warming, the second biggest problem.
That's right. And a nuclear winter, to my mind, is virtually never discussed in the media. Never.
Well, I had a session at a scientific conference for the American Association for the Advancement of Science in February with my colleague Brian Toon and some of our former students, and not many reporters came. One reporter did come from Nature magazine, and she asked me to write an article about how frustrated I was that nobody's paying attention. That was published a couple weeks ago in Nature. But it's still frustrating that the people in Russia and the U.S. don't realize that while the reduction that's going on now is good, we still have to reduce many more. I mean, and then there's another issue. There are 9 countries now that have nuclear weapons. There used to be just 0, 1, 2. The first 5 countries were the U.S., Russia, Britain, France, and China. But then now there's 4 other countries that have them. There's Israel, Pakistan, India, and North Korea. And so a couple years ago, we were thinking, what would happen if there was a war between India and Pakistan using nuclear weapons? They each now have about 100.
Mm.
So we said, what if they each use 50 weapons? And what if they use very small ones, the same size that were dropped on Hiroshima, 15 kilotons? That's like 1% of a megaton. I mean, it's still a huge bomb, but it's tiny compared to some of the bombs in the arsenal now. And so we said, how much smoke would there be if these were dropped on the targets in these countries that would produce lots of smoke, mainly the cities? And we were surprised to find out that it wouldn't be nuclear winter, but we were surprised to find out the global average temperature would go down by 2 degrees Fahrenheit, 1.25 degrees Celsius, for several years. It wouldn't be nuclear winter, but it would shorten the growing season in the middle latitudes, in Australia, in Argentina, in the United States, in Europe, in Russia,
China.
In China. Places far away from where the bombs were dropped, because the smoke would go up into the atmosphere and be blown around the world and last for years. And so we're doing some work now to really quantify how different crops would react to a few degrees colder, a little bit less rain. And I think probably the indirect effect would be more important. That is, if there was a war and people started worrying about the possibility of not having food, they would stop trading food. And it's the trading, I mean, my source of food is the grocery store.
Yeah.
And now I can get food from around the world.
Yeah.
And if people stop trading, that would produce food shortages, especially in places that can't grow their own. Probably agricultural production would go down in places, but if they stop trading, that would be a huge problem.
Why would they stop trading?
Well, we have examples. Last year in Russia, they had a drought and fires, you remember, in Moscow.
Yes, I do. Yes.
And it affected their wheat crop, and they said, we're going to stop exporting wheat.
Because we need
next
it.
Because we need it.
Yeah.
China had a drought last winter. They decided to stop exporting wheat. They started buying wheat, even though they could produce all their own before that. And so if people see a potential danger, they'll just stop selling it because they need it to keep it.
Yeah. So, the scenario of of India and Pakistan going to war, so to speak, and having a nuclear war, that would induce what you call nuclear autumn with gross reduction in crops. How long would that last and how many people would that impact, Alan Robock?
I don't call it nuclear autumn because it's only a couple degrees colder, but it would impact the whole world and it would last for years. And so you can imagine some crops, the temperature would go down so much that they would never get to the point of maturing and there would be no harvest. In other crops, they would grow more slowly and the harvest would be less. People are very clever, though. They could start trying to figure out using different seeds or modifying their practices. And we really need a lot more research to really quantify all the details because different places and different parts of the world have different crops and different farming practices and different soil. And
I thought you had an estimate of how many people would die.
No.
No, we don't.
Ira Helfand, who's working with us, who's a medical doctor, said maybe a billion people would die, but that assumes that there would be a stop in agricultural trade. And so there are places right now, not where you or I live, but where many people live in Africa and other places, where they're just on the brink of starvation now. And a lot of places, food is brought in from outside. So any small perturbation to their life would be devastating.
I'm interviewing Dr. Alan Robock, a distinguished professor of climatology at the University of Rutgers in the Department of Environmental Sciences. Alan, also there would be a tremendous reduction in ozone in the stratosphere. Can you describe, A, how much ozone depletion there would be in an all-out nuclear war at the moment, and B, ozone depletion with a small nuclear war between Pakistan and India and what the ramifications of that would be ecologically and environmentally?
Even with a small, quote, small nuclear war between India and Pakistan, there would be massive ozone depletion. The reason is that the smoke would go up into the stratosphere and, as I said, it would absorb the sunlight, preventing it from getting to the ground. But when it absorbs the sunlight, it heats the stratosphere. Temperatures would go up by 50 degrees, 70 degrees Celsius, and the chemical reactions that destroy ozone depend on the temperature, and so because it would be so much warmer, that would act to destroy the ozone. And even though there would be smoke there, there would be more ultraviolet radiation getting to the ground. Ultraviolet radiation is dangerous for crops, dangerous for animals, and dangerous for the food web at the surface of the ocean. And so it would be like everybody getting sunburned very, very quickly everywhere.
Within 5 minutes.
Yeah. So at the right now, we're worried about ozone depletion because of the chemicals that we've put up in the stratosphere over the last decades, the chlorine. And around the South Pole in the spring, you get an ozone hole because of the chemical reactions on the particles there. And if the ozone gets down to a certain level, we say it's an ozone hole. But it goes away after a couple months, and it's only around the polar vortex. Sometimes little blobs of enhanced ultraviolet comes over Australia, depending on the wind. Mm. After nuclear war, the levels would be that low globally. So it would be basically an ozone hole everywhere around the world. And it would last for years.
As well as people getting sunburned, it would kill the algae in the surface of the oceans, which is the base of the food chain of the sea, and it would damage crops, and it would damage vision. It would damage people's eyes too very much, wouldn't it? People could go blind.
Yeah, not just people, all the other animals, too.
Oh, yeah, I forgot all the other animals. They'd all go blind, too.
They don't have sunglasses. They can't put on sunglasses.
No, that's a bit hard for
or hats.
An
yeah.
insect to put on sunglasses or hat. But so with a small nuclear war between India and Pakistan, how much ozone would be destroyed compared to a large nuclear war between Russia and America?
Well, we haven't done the calculation recently for a large war. We found in the past, it would be much more than that. So ozone has a very short lifetime, so it's always being created and it's always being destroyed. And so we would have to do that calculation. We've been concentrating on the Pakistan-India case because that's new and interesting, and we've been trying to get the attention for the governments of India and Pakistan to realize how dangerous these weapons are. I mean,
Don't you think they understand that, Alan?
No, I don't.
Why?
We calculated that 20 million people could die in India and Pakistan from a war between the two countries using half of each of their arsenals. That's half the number of people that died in World War II.
Right.
And, no, people don't understand what nuclear weapons are. They think of them as bigger bombs, and they think of them as they're very proud that they have created them. And to get, I talked to some scientists about going to India and Pakistan and having seminars and educating people about it. And our National Science Foundation has money for that, but I would need to give a partner scientist in India or Pakistan. And they told me if a scientist there helped you out, they wouldn't be arrested or anything, but they would be sort of ostracized from the scientific community and be criticized for talking about something, some national accomplishment that they're very proud of.
Yeah, the weapons are seen as patriotic symbols. In fact, I'm reminded of the title I gave my book in 1984, Missile Envy.
Yes.
They're incredibly proud. And A.Q. Khan, who was the physicist in Pakistan who created the sort of nuclear Walmart around the world, he created the nuclear weapons, many of them in Pakistan. He's a national hero. And he sold the nuclear know-how all over the world. But there is a wonderful physicist in Pakistan, Alan Robock, who I had at one of my symposia, I can't remember his name, who speaks out very strongly against the arms race in South Asia. Do you remember his name?
I'm not sure who you mean.
No, he's wonderful. Well, now, then, so how long would the ozone depletion last?
It would last for several years. Yeah, just the smoke has a lifetime of about more than 5 years. After 5 years, about a third of it would still be there, and then the effects on ozone would be about a third after 5 years. And so that's something also. I mean, if we're going to look at impacts on crops, we have to look at the excess ultraviolet radiation as well as the reduced precipitation, reduced temperatures, reduced amount of sunlight that they use for photosynthesis.
So if we got the data yet on the number of people that would be induced into starvation following a nuclear war between Pakistan and India?
Well, like I said, you would have to sort of have a good way to predict how agricultural trade would change and how much food would, the direct production of food would be affected to some extent in different places.
But up to a billion people could possibly starve?
Sure.
A billion. That's a round figure. Okay, so how likely is it that a nuclear war between Pakistan and India could occur? And I know they nearly went to war over a border issue about 6-7 years ago, and that they do see these weapons, as you've just said, as sort of kind of ordinary bombs. You know, they don't quite understand the implications scientifically of nuclear weapons. So what is the likelihood or possibility, Alan Robock, do you think, of India and Pakistan going to nuclear war?
I'm a weatherman. I'm a climatologist. I'm not an expert in that. So I'm just
asking you off the top of your head.
Well, I can just sort of guess. I mean, you're right. Along the Kashmir border, there are disputes. There are armies poised on either side.
Yes.
And a little bit of and of course, you know, in Mumbai a year ago, there was this terrorist attack by Pakistanis coming in and by boat and killing people in hotels and in the Jewish center and attacking people, and 100 or more people died.
Yeah.
And fortunately, that didn't escalate into a war between the countries. But you can imagine things like that with people thinking that they have to respond or feeling threatened and not being able to make decisions under stress and having to make decisions quickly, and it could escalate. And once bombs are used, communication breaks down, people become very stressed, mm-hmm. and it's hard. It's easy to imagine a scenario like that. The only way to prevent it is to get rid of the bombs. And what's ironic is you can't use a bomb. If you use a bomb, it's like committing suicide.
A hydrogen bomb, nuclear bomb, yeah.
Yeah, if the U.S. attacked Russia or Russia attacked the U.S., there would be, and the other country didn't reply, didn't respond, everybody in the first country would die from starvation from the climate effects. And rational people understand that they can't be used. I mean, there have been lots of disputes, lots of wars. Russia has fought in Afghanistan. The U.S. fought in Vietnam and Afghanistan and Iraq and on and on. And they've never used nuclear weapons. So we've been really lucky that they haven't. And rational people understand they can't even be used. And so why do we even have them? Why don't we get rid of them? Now, there are other countries, Britain, France, and China. Each one of them has about 200 weapons, 200 or 300 weapons. They could make as many as they want. They're rich countries. They've chosen to have 200 weapons, and that's enough for a deterrent for a national defense. I mean, how many bombs do you have to put on the capital city of your enemy to deter them from attacking you?
All nuts. It's absolute nuclear insanity as far as I...
The point is the U.S. and Russia could quickly get down to 200 weapons each and still maintain their deterrence, and then we could work on the harder problem of getting rid of all the weapons.
But
and
if what they does got deterrence down, even mean? I don't even understand the logical definition of deterrence. What does it mean? You know, if you bomb us, we'll bloody blow up Moscow and all your cities. It's you know, you're talking about rational human beings, but the truth is most of us, our emotions are motivated by our reptilian midbrain, and we use our neocortex to justify our reptilian midbrain emotions. And when push comes to shove, how many of us are really rational? If our wife is desperately sick, or we've got terrible flu, or our child is sick, or, you know, has just had a car accident, we're not rational. We're not rational. And yet we we're rational.
I've discussed with my father about whether we should have dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and I told him, no, we could have done a demonstration bomb. We didn't have to kill all those people. And he was in the Navy in World War II, and no, it helped end the war more quickly. But it turns out that we were already doing genocidal bombing attacks on cities in Germany and Japan before that, and killing everybody in another city wasn't much different from how we were already behaving.
Yep.
I think humans are getting better about that, but not nearly fast enough.
Better about what?
About not committing genocide.
Well, what about the fact that America's killed over a million people, civilians in Iraq? That's genocide. According to The Lancet. That's genocide, Alan. It is. Because George W. Didn't like Hussein.
A million people?
Yes, it's over a million. That's the estimate. It was published in The Lancet.
I see. But they weren't out to kill people per se.
Oh, yes, they were. They used cluster bombs. They're using depleted uranium, which is giving, you know, a lot of kids cancer and deformed babies. They've used the most ghastly weapons, daisy cutters, fuel air explosives. I actually wrote about all the weapons that they've been using in my book, The New Nuclear Danger, George Bush's Military-Industrial Complex. No, it's been absolutely hideous. And I think we've got to get to the point to try and analyze why men kill. And that's a big subject. Because if we keep killing, we're going to, I think, induce nuclear winter. That's the sort of bottom line.
Well, let me tell you another story. So I've been trying to get the attention of different people to pay attention to my work. And in August, I got this email from a former student from Cuba who said the Cubans would like you to come to Havana and give a talk about climate change. And I wrote back, I don't understand. What's this about? And he said, I have no idea. The next day, he sent me a webpage of Fidel Castro talking to the head of the Cuban Weather Bureau about nuclear winter. He said, maybe they want you to come talk about that. And it ended up that was the case. And in September, I went to Havana and gave my talk about nuclear winter, and Fidel Castro came to the talk. He listened for an hour to my lecture, and then I talked with him for another half hour afterwards. It was broadcast on nationwide television the next day in prime time. There was the newspapers had four pages about my talk, and so I felt really happy that at least in one country people were paying attention to it.
Poor Alan, this has got to be international, Alan. I've got to be able to help you somehow. This is just ridiculous that you're not getting the airtime to educate the global population about, you know, the dire consequences of a nuclear war. I want to just move on now to Russia and America. We know that each of them have over probably 2,000 hydrogen bombs on hair trigger alert, ready to be launched by a 3-minute decision time by either president, and the weapons take half an hour to reach their destination after launch. What's really been worrying me lately too, Alan Robock, is hacking. Now, the Pentagon is talking about cyber warfare and hackers hacking into their Pentagon, you know, systems and possibly their early warning systems, because all these weapons are under computer control. We know the Chinese are hacking into the Pentagon systems. And the Pentagon, I think last week, issued a statement to say that if there is cyber warfare against the Pentagon, they're going to bomb the country responsible. But what if someone hacked in, and I can't see how it could be too difficult, hacked into the early warning system, some sort of computer geek who was had Asperger's and was a little bit psychotic or whoever, and launched a nuclear war? Have you thought about that possibility, Alan Robock?
No, I don't. I haven't, but now I'm thinking about it. when I worked at Lawrence Livermore Laboratory one summer when I was a graduate student, where they developed the bombs, I worked on air pollution, but there, computers were completely unconnected to the internet, so nobody could get into them through the internet.
Right.
I think it's but that's the case in Iran too, and they got
the Stuxnet.
I think the
virus.
U.S. or the Israelis got a virus in there by carrying thumb drives and plugging them in. So,
yes.
No, that's pretty scary. I know that they have human beings actually have to finally push the button, but they only do it if somebody tells them to, and they wouldn't know whether it was the right command or not. No, it's pretty scary. And so since we can't use nuclear weapons anyway, because they would be suicide, and for planetary hygiene purposes, we have to get rid of them as soon as we can, and we are still going to have way too many even after the new START agreement is completely implemented.
Oh, the START agreement, to my mind, really doesn't do anything.
Well,
except all it does was allow Obama to talk to the Russians and some inspectors, yes, but I can't imagine America letting Russian inspectors in to do their deeds, you know, as freely as they need to. I can't imagine the Pentagon opening itself up. The other thing is, you know, talking about computers, Alan, during the rollover of Y2K, I was in the White House because, you know, people were really worried there could be nuclear meltdowns at reactors because they're under computer control. Corporations spent billions and billions of dollars upgrading their computers because the banking system was at risk, the whole thing. And my worry was that there could be a nuclear war. Well, so I'm in the White House in the sort of office for the Y2K thing, and they put me on to a conference call with the Pentagon. And I said, well, what's going on with you blokes? You know, are you under control? Are you worried? And they said, oh, everything's under control, no worries. Turned out that a few months later, I read after the rollover that in the New York Times that the Pentagon lost its early warning computers for 8 months. They were upgrading them and they lost them all for 8 months. So they lied to me, number one. Number two, they operated without their computers in this system. And number three, my intuition was accurate that we were at great risk. And so apart from human error, we could have computer error. And the risk of nuclear war, I mean, it's so high as far as I'm concerned because of inattention, No one's worrying about it. It's the, you know, it's the elephant in the sitting room that's never mentioned, although Obama did mention it early on. You're getting no attention to say that, you know, nuclear war could cause nuclear winter and we'd all starve to death in the dark, although originally you did in the early 80s. It's very hard for me to understand why there is such a sort of degree of psychic numbing in the global population and particularly in the media about this subject, Alan.
I think it's two things. One is the two great spokesmen for these ideas, Carl Sagan and Steve Schneider, are no longer with us.
Yes.
And they were just charismatic people who got people's attention.
Mm.
The other thing is just denial. People don't want to hear it, so they just close. I give talks about it, and people. I'm going to give a talk to a community group tomorrow morning, but people get really depressed at the end. You've got to give them something to do, but people don't want to hear it. Steve Schneider published a paper that said it would be nuclear autumn, not nuclear winter, because his climate model didn't get quite as much cooling as Carl Sagan's did. And even though he said by autumn, I don't mean picnics and football games. I mean, when the leaves fall off the trees and crops die, and it would still be devastating for agriculture. But people chose to say, "Okay, now I want it. I'm going to believe that it's nuclear autumn, and it's not so bad because it felt better." It's really hard for people to process something that feels so bad and then act on it.
Well, yeah, I think I'll probably disagree with that because in the 80s, I spoke to probably millions of people via the media, but also face-to-face, huge audiences all over America, describing the medical implications of nuclear winter and nuclear war. And people would go through their Kubler-Ross stages of grief, shock and disbelief. They didn't want to hear it. They thought I was a bit nuts anyway. I'd made one mistake in my whole speech so they could discount the lot. Then depression, profound depression, often for a long time. Then anger. And I found as they moved through those processes of grief, when they reached the angry stage, they got motivated. And by God, were they effective. And in fact, we did help to end the Cold War, that huge, massive movement, with your data and with the data of nuclear war per se. And in fact, people can do something. We can eradicate those blasted bombs. We can get rid of them. We've got a president now who would like to abolish nuclear weapons, but he said, I can't do it alone. I have to have all of you supporting me. And everyone sitting on their bottoms, doing their Facebooks and their computers and their iPods and God knows what, and not getting out there like the Egyptians have done, you know, or the people in Wisconsin. We've got to use our bodies. And for Christ's sake, we've got to move or our kids will have no future. Sorry about the soliloquy or cadenza or whatever, Alan. But I'm just telling you where I'm at and my experience, which is pretty vast, at motivating a huge, you know, actually global population. People can be motivated to move. And I think they need their emotions to be validated and to say, yeah, it's totally appropriate to be depressed, but for God's sake, when you come through that and get into your angry phase, we're going to do it. I mean, we need to take over the Pentagon. That's our money. Over $1 trillion a year is spent on death in America. Death. And America is the only Western country without any form of decent medical care system. And I don't know, what does it take to wake up a comfortable population with full bellies, I suppose?
I know. I'm a scientist. I'm not a politician.
I know.
And I'm a
doctor.
Yeah, I know. But I try to make my results widely known. I published a paper in Scientific American last year. I write to the president's science advisor. I try to get attention. I was on when my visit to Fidel Castro ended up on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. So we've gotten a little bit of publicity, but it's not enough for people to put it to the top of their list of things that they care about, especially when there's a lot of people have economic problems.
Yeah, I know, but economic problems, so what if the world blows up tomorrow?
Well, I spend a lot of my time worrying about this and doing something about it. I also don't understand why everybody else doesn't care about it.
No. I'm interviewing Dr. Alan Robock, who's the Distinguished Professor of Climatology at the Department of Environmental Sciences at Rutgers University. Alan, here's a suggestion. What if you and I do a 1-2 soft shoe shuffle together. You do the, you know, that the scientific, medical, scientific nuclear winter stuff. I do the medical stuff, and then at the end I know how to, as a physician, establishing a doctor-patient relationship with my audience to get into their emotions, their feelings, their altruistic instincts, their love for their children. Often at the end of my talk, I'll find a baby in the audience and hold a baby up and say, this is what I've been talking about. And then everyone loses it and cries. I mean, that's just a suggestion off the top of my head. You mightn't go for that.
No, that's fine. I was in Geneva at the United Nations a month ago giving my talk at a Mayors for Peace function that they organized, and the Swiss government has actually given us some funding to look at the agricultural impacts of nuclear winter, and a colleague in Switzerland is doing some more climate model calculations. So there's little bits of people are interested. We've been trying to get a paper published in Lancet or another medical journal about the medical implications of this, and having a very difficult time getting them to understand how important
really?
This is.
Really? Really?
Yeah.
The Lancet?
Yeah.
I'm surprised. What worries me now about Pakistan is that America's moving into Pakistan with their drones and bombing civilians. Pakistan is a very, very unstable country that when I wrote my book, The New Nuclear Danger, some years ago, at that time, over 50% of people in the Pakistani military were composed of Taliban, who America actually produced and trained to fight the Soviet Union. Their prime minister or their president's a really hopeless character. He is the widower of Benazir Bhutto, who was killed, and he's been in jail for fraud in the past. What worries me is that if there is a big movement in Pakistan, the Taliban kind of take over, or, you know, there's great unrest, those weapons, and they say Pakistan may have 200 nuclear weapons now.
No, I think it's more like 110, something
110
like that.
Could end up in the hands of these people. Have you thought about that?
Oh, yeah, that scares me, too. I wonder if the U.S., if they could find Osama, if they could also know where all the weapons are, could go take them out at some
point.
I don't
think they do know. I think one of the reasons they're in Pakistan is because of this very situation. That's what I've read. But I don't think they really do know them all. And the whole area is so unstable with Afghanistan and Pakistan and India too, in fact. So, Alan, what are we going to do? Well, you're the scientist and you're doing the noble work. I guess I have to get on my white charger again and start charging around the country, helping you and talking much more about nuclear winter, although I have to tell you that... Go on.
So I think a movie, a love story and about a scientist and incorporating this into it, that, you know, a feature film would get people's attention.
Do you?
The day after my talk in Cuba, we went into this hotel and my talk was supposed to be on TV, and I went to the bar and there was a Julia Roberts film on the TV, and I asked the bartender, could you change the channel? And sure enough, there I was giving my lecture. And what that taught me was that if you want to get people's attention, you need a movie with Julia Roberts in it, not a professor giving a lecture, because that's what he would prefer to watch. And if you could get a feature film with it's easy to write, you know, the love story, and then have this whole climate change and problems in Pakistan or in Russia in the background, I think that would get people's attention, really, to dramatize it for people to understand what it would really be like. There was a movie done recently about the danger of nuclear weapons, but it was really very dry,
yeah,
and nobody watched it.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
You need something with human emotion in it for people to pay attention.
Well, what about you, Alan Robock, having a love affair with Julia Roberts in a film? See, that would combine both the scientist and the beautiful actress.
Yeah, I wonder who would play me.
No, you play you. Well, I think you should play you.
But if you could get somebody in Hollywood interested in something like this, a script like this, that would be, you could combine education with a good story. I think that's the way to do it.
Well, you know, when they played The Day After with Jason Robards, and mm-hmm. and that was widely watched. The Day After was about a nuclear
right.
war in which
right.
city was it? I can't remember which city. But that was very powerful, and in fact, the majority of Americans watched that film, and then they had counseling sessions from psychologists for teenagers and children who'd seen it, so that they could be counseled about their emotions. That was at the height of the fear of nuclear war that we sort of mobilized together with Carl Sagan and all the rest. And now I think when the Cold War ended, everyone thought, well, thank God that's over. We can lie on our couch and watch television and watch Julia Roberts again and not even worry about it. But of course, as we know, and you know full well, the risk has not abated. It's the same. I think it's even bigger because people think it's gone away.
Yes, so that's why I give talks about it and tell people about it. But I think you need a way to get a larger audience, not one person at a time.
Yeah, I agree with that. Well, Alan, we've just about reached the end of our time, and it's been a fascinating talk, and I hope everyone who's listened takes this into their heart and soul and gut, and realizing that, in fact, what Alan referred to earlier, that global warming is nothing compared to nuclear winter. And I facetiously sometimes said in my speeches, well, maybe nuclear winter's the answer to global warming, huh?
No.
That's naughty.
Global warming is happening, and
yep.
it is a danger. Nuclear winter is a possibility,
yes.
And we can stop it from happening by getting rid of just a few weapons. It's a much easier problem to solve than global warming. There is something called geoengineering, which has been proposed to deal with global warming, that is on purpose putting a cloud up in the stratosphere to block
yeah.
out the sun.
Yeah.
I do a lot of work on that. That's not a good idea either because of the consequences, the side effects. And so,
what would be the side effects?
Well, you could ruin the or affect the summer monsoon circulation over India and China, the amount of rain that affects the food supply for a couple billion people. You would also have ozone depletion. You wouldn't do anything about the ocean getting more acidified. And people might consider using it as a weapon.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of reasons why it's not a good idea, why reducing the emissions of greenhouse gases, of carbon dioxide, is the solution. And it's doable if people have the will. It's a political problem. It's not
and
a technical
problem. And if we can get
problem.
The blasted corporations out of the pockets of the Congress people, that's what we need to do. But the other thing is, as we speak, this volcano in Chile, which is erupting, and I'm now in Australia, flights have been cancelled left, right and centre around the southern hemisphere because planes can't fly through volcanic ash. And you know what fascinates me, Alan, is that in the plans for nuclear war, there were always airplanes circling B-52s continuously to fly to Russia if, in fact, the nuclear war started to drop their payload. And the guys had to wear a patch over one eye because if they saw nuclear explosions, they would be blinded. Then they could take the patch off and they'd have one functional eye. But the other thing was that they couldn't fly home because of the incredible smoke, and the jets can't fly through that smoke like they can't fly through volcanic ash because they would crash.
Yeah, and what that volcano in Chile teaches us is that the particles can get up in the stratosphere and be blown all the way around the world, and that's
yeah.
the same thing that would happen with the smoke from fires from nuclear war.
Yeah.
There's an even bigger eruption that took place in Ethiopia, Eritrea yesterday that put even more material up in the atmosphere than the one in Chile.
Oh, really?
So then there was Grímsvötn in Iceland couple of months ago, so it's getting quite active, and so I do a lot of work on that. That's nuclear winter is a theory. It's result of our climate models. We never want to do the experiment in the real world, but we can use analogs such as volcanic eruptions to inform us about the theory. And if our models do a good job with volcanic eruptions, that gives us a lot more confidence that we trust their results for the nuclear simulations.
Well, and then there's Fukushima. And I think some of the emissions from Fukushima are actually being lobbed up into the stratosphere and circling around the globe from west to east in the northern hemisphere. Do you know anything about that, Alan?
Well, as far as I know, they never got to the stratosphere.
Oh.
So they do get transported in the lower part of the atmosphere, the troposphere.
Yes.
And they get washed out, and a lot of them went into the ocean. People
yes.
say it was good. The wind was blowing into the ocean, but it wasn't good for the ocean.
No.
And so that teaches us. And the greatest danger I see for nuclear power is that it produces material that can be used for nuclear weapons.
Lateral proliferation, yes.
The enhanced uranium that's used as fuel can produce bombs. The plutonium that's reprocessed can produce bombs.
Yep.
And that's how nuclear weapons spread. And I'm worried about other countries that want nuclear weapons too. And the only way the U.S. and Russia can get other countries to stop spreading them is to set an example and get rid of ours.
Yes, and stop selling nuclear reactors all over the world.
That's the other thing, exactly.
Because nuclear reactors are bomb factories, as you've just clearly explained, Alan.
Mm-hmm.
Well, look, we've run out of time now. It's been absolutely fascinating. I've been looking forward to this very much. And so I hope everyone who listened will take a leaf out of Dr. Alan Robock's book. Note what a wonderful scientist he is, how hard he's trying to save the lives not just of this human generation, but 30 million other species that cohabit the planet with us. Alan, I respect you for your noble work, and we no doubt will be interviewing you in the future, possibly in another year.
Thanks very much for having me and for spreading the information about this danger that we present to ourselves.
Yeah, present to ourselves. Thank you very much, Alan.
Bye-bye.
My guest today on If You Love This Planet was Dr. Alan Robock, a distinguished professor of climatology in the Department of Environmental Sciences at Rutgers University. Thanks for listening to this rather depressing, gloomy, but very important topic. We can do something about it by rising off our couches and our bottoms, taking to the streets and abolishing nuclear weapons once and for all. And America can lead that incredibly important movement. So we'll talk to you again next week. Thanks a lot and bye-bye.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.